I think right now it's a tough call for me to be voting for this bill. I mean, from Alaska's perspective, revenue sharing is not done right.
Alaska's senators react to the new energy bill in Congress. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 28th of July. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, an unusual tagging project to learn more about Sitka's bears.
Where they travel, where they feed, what parts of the day they spend in different areas, and how we impact them in their feeding zones.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Senator Lisa Murkowski and her fellow Republicans are slamming the energy and oil spill bill unveiled last night by the top Senate Democrat. Harry Reid of Nevada gave up on passing a major climate bill this summer due to lack of support, so instead introduced a bill with minor energy goals, like incentives to make homes more efficient. It also includes oil spill legislation that would affect operators in Alaska. It would remove the current $75 million liability cap on economic damages from an oil spill. Senator Murkowski says that will cut out small operators and enable more foreign companies to set up shop on America's shores.
That does pose a problem about the ongoing viability of production within the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere by those other than the biggest of the big, the super majors, and those national petroleum companies such as China Petroleum, those that can self-insure.
Murkowski's Energy Committee has created its own version of a spill bill. So has Senator Mark Begich's Commerce Committee, which finished marking up or editing a bill of its own last night. Begich says while Reid used some of their ideas, the provisions for Alaska were left out. He calls that pretty thin.
I think right now it's a tough call for me to be voting for this bill. I mean, from Alaska's perspective, revenue sharing is not done right.
Begich says instead of sharing the profits of offshore drilling with states, shared revenue would go into a conservation fund to buy more federal land. Begich says there's already plenty of that. He's also concerned because the Reid bill does not include funding for Alaska's regional citizens advisory councils, which were set up after the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
But the new one for the Gulf of Mexico gets the funding. What's the advantage there for Alaska, that the Gulf gets taken care of because they just happen to have the most recent disaster? And the reason they can do that citizen advisory committee down there is because they're modeling it after ours that were here for 20 years.
Begich wants to establish an Arctic Citizens Advisory Council so locals have input into Arctic Ocean development. But Governor Sean Parnell is criticizing that plan. His special assistant, Joe Balash, says it could disrupt the state's authority and doesn't allow the governor to appoint its members.
The question is whether or not we're adding another layer of review, creating legal vulnerabilities and opportunities for litigation to stop what is otherwise rational, reasonable development.
Begich disagrees and says the governor is probably misinformed about how it would work.
Actually has the one group that should be involved, the citizens who have the right and ownership of this oil and gas. It's not some government, it's the people. And so they will actually have an opportunity. And what's so important about this is when you do this at the front end, the odds are you will resolve issues before they turn into litigation.
Senator Reid hopes to move quickly on his energy oil spill bill, but he'll need the support of members like Begich, and the Senate only has one more week in Washington before it recesses for a month. Several villages near the Kuskokwim River got a chance to meet with the top administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Lisa Jackson and her entourage traveled by bush plane to meet with tribal leaders. Her visit is part of an effort by the Obama administration to strengthen ties with Alaska Native tribes. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
High-ranking federal policymakers seem to be making a habit of visiting the YK Delta. There was the visit from the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs last summer, And then last fall, four U.S. secretaries made the trip. But this trip was the first of its kind in the village of Chefornik, says the tribal administrator, Jonathan Lewis.
It's the first time they ever seen someone, a high official, come out and see firsthand what we experience in communities like this.
Jackson met with the entire tribal council and others from the Bering Sea village. The village is without flush toilets or running water in homes, so she was expecting to hear a lot about water and sewer issues. But the village used their short time with her to discuss another pressing issue.
I asked them what was the biggest challenge, and it wasn't water and wastewater, it was erosion. And the fact that they're worried about just having a place to be, losing the land, and the land that they've lost was tribal land.
Like many villages in Alaska, Chefornik is dealing with increased erosion. The Uksikfuk River has been eating away at their shoreline. Again, Jonathan Lewis.
The water goes underneath the soil and takes the soil out from underneath, and then the riverbank just erodes off.
In 2007, a federal judge ruled that the EPA should be regulating greenhouse gases, gases like carbon emissions from vehicles that international scientists say are causing climate change. Elders in the village told Jackson stories of how they see climate change affecting them.
What I hear from the elders, that back then the weather was always, it was hardly any storms. You can walk down with a candle and use it like a flashlight, and it wouldn't flicker away because of there was no wind. That was how calm it used to be back then.
Lewis says the elders in his village say that wind and waves started pounding away at their shorelines with increased fervor starting in the 1980s.
It's not getting any better. It's getting worse and worse. There's more wind, more storms, and that's contributing to the erosion problem.
Lewis also says that shorter winters have been gradually melting the permafrost. It used to be about 2 feet below the soil in most locations near Chefornik, but a recent survey conducted by Coastal Villages Region Fund shocked village leaders.
The 8-foot probe, metal probe, that they stick into went all the way down before it even hit the permafrost.
Second on their list of concerns was their landfill. Like many villages across rural Alaska, it's inadequate. Lewis says their dump is causing safety issues because there's no funding to pay for trash pickup. That means every household must take their trash to the dump themselves.
Those people that walk there, they go back to their house and cause health problems in their homes.
Jackson says the three-village trip was informative. She also visited Kasigluk and Napakiak and saw a way of living much different from the urban East Coast where she spent most of her career.
We met lots of people, and everywhere we went, people offered us food. It was fish, you know. It was folks were just finishing up, catching all their fish and drying it and getting ready for the winter to come. And a lot of places we weren't, everyone was out getting berries.
And while she was learning, Jackson says she was also speaking about the EPA's renewed emphasis on cooperation.
One of the things President Obama has been clear about is that it's about consulting with tribes, consulting with Alaska Native peoples, and giving them a voice to determine what it is they want and what it is they need.
From yesterday's meeting, I think the communities were optimistic, very optimistic.
But Lewis says only time will tell if the visit has an impact in his village.
There's a saying, actions speak louder than words.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Mountain Village will remain a dry community, according to the unofficial tally from yesterday's special election. The ballot question was whether or not the community should go damp, allowing the possession of alcohol in the village but not allowing local sales. City Manager Anita Andrews says that 118 voted to remain dry, with 61 votes to go damp. There are still 32 questioned and absentee ballots left to be counted, but they're not enough to change the outcome. The local canvas board still has to meet to make the election results official. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, addressing a common tragedy in Alaska that's often preventable.
Brain injury occurs in an instant, but in that instant, not only is that person's life changed, but the lives of people around that person are changed as well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
58 members of Congress have signed a letter opposing Sealaska's land selection legislation. The group of Democrats asked House committee leaders to keep the bill out of any larger public lands measure. Supporters and opponents have said it's most likely to pass as part of an omnibus lands bill. The letter was released yesterday by the Alaska Wilderness League, based in Washington, D.C. It says the selections bill would, quote, give the green light to industrial clear-cutting of the best remaining old growth in the United States. League spokeswoman Gwen Dobbs says the letter was spearheaded by Representatives Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut and Raul Grijalva of Arizona.
We're very much in support of these members of Congress coming forward and really showing leadership in terms of protecting our natural resource. And I think that we really commend them for coming out and asking their colleagues to protect the Tongass.
The bill would allow Sea Alaska to complete its land selections outside boundaries set by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The Southeast Native Corporation and its supporters say the measure would boost the region's economy and allow for a sustainable timber industry. The letter was sent to the co-chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, the first stop for Don Young's version of the bill. Young was aware that the letter was being circulated and sent his own letter discouraging colleagues from signing on. It said the legislation would not increase loss of old-growth trees in the Tongass. The bill's main focus has been in the Senate Resources Committee, where Lisa Murkowski's version is undergoing changes. Robert Dillon is Murkowski's committee spokesman.
She's listening to, you know, stakeholders from all groups and local residents who are impacted by this bill, who have interest in it. She's not paying too much attention to liberals in Congress who are trying to stop Alaska legislation.
Murkowski released a series of amendments to the measure July 1st. Dillon says they are still under consideration and no hearing date has been set. Earlier this month, two hatcheries in Sitka both suffered devastating accidents over the same weekend. The Sheldon Jackson hatchery lost about 240,000 salmon fry when a water intake pipe became blocked. At Medvigi Hatchery, a few miles south, the damage was worse. A closed water intake valve resulted in the loss of nearly a million Chinook fry. But Medvigi also has been conducting an experimental program that, in the weeks since the accident, has helped the hatchery recover from the damage caused by the accident. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Sitka's Medvigi Hatchery is at the end of a narrow dirt road about 10 miles outside the center of town. It sits inside a secluded cove where, down in the water, floating metal boardwalks encircle saltwater pens full of salmon. And right now, the salmon are getting antsy, jumping out of the water in front of a fish ladder like the crowd at a Thanksgiving weekend doorbuster sale. The hatchery is run by the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, or NSRA.
It's probably one of the most complicated Chinook rearing programs in the state.
Lon Garrison is NSRA's operations manager. He says Medvigi produces about 4 million Chinook each year.
About 2 million of those Chinook smolts come from our, you know, a more traditional program where we call that a yearling program. Those are fish that we keep. We actually have them on site for longer than a year. They're almost, from when we take the eggs to when we release, it's almost 18 months.
The other 2 million are called zero checks.
They may experience a rapid enough growth rate that they meet the minimum threshold to be able to smolt, which is the process that makes them be able to go to saltwater from a freshwater environment and go early.
At Medvigi, zero-check smolt come from Green Lake, where the hatchery has some fish pens. The water temperature in the raceways at the hatchery site, where yearlings mature, is between roughly 43 and 46 degrees Fahrenheit. But up in Green Lake, it's warmer, about 50 to 59 degrees Fahrenheit.
The warmer the water, the quicker the fish can grow. Their metabolism increases. Well, we stumbled upon the fact that the first couple of years, that as they were feeding those fish, they grew really fast, and we noticed that some of them were smolting. And they were smolting in the middle of the summer. So it led us to experiment with a couple of things and actually take a group, put them in the lake a little early, grow them as fast as we could, and see if we could actually make them smolt.
And it worked. Now, fast forward to the beginning of July. An accidentally closed valve inside one of the hatchery's on-site raceways resulted in the death of nearly a million young Chinook. The fry that died were yearlings, those Chinook that stay in the freshwater for more than a year. And when the accident happened, the zero-check fish had just been moved from freshwater into saltwater. To replenish the fish inside the freshwater raceways, the staff at the hatchery decided to see what would happen if they moved 100 of the zero-check fish out of the saltwater and back into freshwater.
If they had all died right within the first few days, we would know that that wasn't going to be a possibility.
But obviously it went pretty well.
We had no mortality.
A good sign. So more fish were sent, almost a million.
And we had to use two fish pumps and a lot of hose. You know, it's about 700 feet of 4-inch pipe and hose.
And now they're all inside the raceways, six large aluminum tanks, basically, each at waist height off the ground and a little longer than a semi-truck. The raceways are housed inside a long white building where Garrison opens the door, turns off the radio, and points into a tank crowded with the new zero-check smolt.
You know, it's not all science. It's like, you know, raising cattle or chickens or whatever, you know. You have to have this kind of intimate connection with the critters that you're working with and understand what you're seeing and say, oh, well, you know, the fish aren't behaving right, or they're starting to peck at each other. We're starting to see fins that are getting eaten or eyes that are getting pecked a little bit. They start getting aggressive with each other. Maybe we need to change the feeding regimen a little bit. So a number of different things that you have to take into consideration. So it's some of it's science and some of it's art, so to speak.
The zero-check fish in the raceways now are about twice the size of the yearlings who were lost. And Garrison says the new challenge will be making sure they don't outgrow their surroundings before it's time to release them in the fall. Once they are released, they could have a lower survival rate than their yearling cousins. About 2% of yearlings come back, compared to about 0.5% of zero-check. But Garrison says it's still enough to make the program worthwhile. This is Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
Last week's fire at a Hoonah sawmill has been called accidental. Deputy State Fire Marshal Bob Plum says it's believed that some sawdust smoldering in the mill building likely ignited a small aerosol or propane cylinder. The fire destroyed the mill building and the head rig saw, but Sue Tyler of Icy Straits Lumber and Milling says their secondary manufacturing facilities and log and lumber inventory stored on site are largely intact. She credits the Hoonah Fire Department for containing the blaze. Tyler says they had a little insurance, but it may not be enough to cover the mill's replacement.
You know, we really want to thank everybody so much for their emails and phone calls and just words of support. It's meant a lot to us, and you know, we're still trying to, you know, figure things out, but that, you know, we hope whatever we do will be best, you know, for the community and the surrounding communities.
Icy Straits supplied high value added wood products throughout Southeast Alaska. A small retail outlet was planned for Lemon Creek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
Alaska has one of the highest incidences of brain injuries in the nation. More than 10,000 Alaskans live with a lifelong disability resulting from a brain injury.
If you talk to the Brain Injury Association of America, they'll tell you the only cure for brain injury is prevention, and prevention is so key. You know, a brain injury occurs in an instant, but in that instant, not only is that person's life changed, but the lives of people around that person are changed as well.
That's Dr. Harvey Jacobs, a national expert on brain injuries. He's in Anchorage this week to share information at the Alaska Brain Injury Conference. Dr. Jacobs says the consequences of a brain injury can be devastating.
Brain injury starts out as a medical challenge, but ultimately, for far too many people, becomes a social catastrophe. because after brain injury, people continue to experience many challenges, especially with severe brain injury. And there are a number of people who are unable to work, or there are changes in the way they think, and also behavioral processes which change their roles and relationships with people around them.
He says anyone can be susceptible to such an injury. Falls, vehicle accidents, and physical assaults are the most common causes, and all age groups are vulnerable. Dr. Jacobs says prevention is the key.
The work that's been done in traffic safety over the past 20 years has been significant. Wearing a seatbelt is probably the most important thing you can do, not only to save your life or to save a life with lifelong disability, but also to protect your family or the people around you whose roles, relationships, and responsibilities are going to change. Since the introduction of seatbelt laws, along with changes in the technology of cars with airbags, we've been able to reduce the number of brain injuries that occur, and we've been able to change the statistics so that motor vehicle accidents are no longer the primary cause of brain injury.
He says wearing bicycle and motorcycle helmets is essential to protect the brain. A good investment, he says, considering the jello-like brain can be injured even by a mild blow. According to Center for Disease Control data, the financial losses due to brain injuries in our society could be up to $100 billion a year in costs of care and lost economic opportunities. There are 1.7 million brain-injured people in the United States, and 80,000 to 100,000 of them have permanent disabilities. Jill Hodges, executive director of the Alaska Brain Injury Network, says the Bethel area has the highest incidence of brain injuries in the state. 800 Alaskans are hospitalized each year with moderate to severe brain injuries. 650 of those survive.
In rural Alaska, such as in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, the top three causes are falls, followed by ATV and snow machine crashes, and then also assault.
Males aged 16 to 24 are at the highest risk, but infants are at risk too because of shaken baby syndrome. She says a lot of work has to be done to convince bush snow machiners and four-wheelers to wear head protection. She says the state and the Alaska Native Health Consortium have made some efforts in this direction. Hodges says in rural Alaska, CT scans are rare, so most injured rural residents are medevaced to Anchorage or Seattle for acute care, but on return to the village, the state and the regional behavioral health service become the primary caregivers. Hodges says there is no single rehabilitative care center in Alaska, but progress is being made in that direction. Four brown bears were tagged and collared this week at Sitka's Fortress of the Bear. The collars will allow the bears to be tracked and studied in the future. KCAW's Shady Grove Oliver was at the fortress as the bears wrapped up their unlikely adventure.
In case you ever wondered what a snoring bear sounds like, yes, this is it. So how did a sow and three cubs come to be sleeping in the Fortress of the Bear at 11:30 a.m. on a Tuesday morning? Well, here's what happened. The fortress is usually a place for bears who will no longer live in the wild. Four very wild bears decided to come and visit, more or less.
Well, they came in on their own. They've been in the area, and we baited them in.
That's Les Kinnear, director of the Fortress of the Bear.
Put some food in the habitat, rigged the gate to close and latch on its own, and it worked to a degree, and came out at about 10 o'clock last night, and all four of the bears were in the habitat. We were delighted to see that all three of the cubs were still here. We had worried a little bit that one of them may have been the one that was killed at Thimbleberry last week, but as you can see, they're all still here.
It's very important that the bears be collared and tagged so that they can be monitored in the future. Tracking these bears can help scientists and wildlife personnel better understand Sitka's bear population as a whole.
Learning more about them, get more information, where they travel, where they feed, what parts of the day they spend in different areas, and how we impact them in their feeding zones. So this is all information that we need to know to be able to live better in their backyard and they in ours.
Fortress volunteer Debbie Terry says the bears had been hanging around the fortress for a while before they were baited in.
They kind of watch from the mountain. They come down at night. They scale over somewhere over the barbed wire and just kind of come around and scout around, see if they can find any leftover food. And they actually have found a way into the shed that has hay, and they may have slept there overnight, so they've been really smart about finding resources for themselves.
They spent the night in the fortress and seemed pretty comfortable when I arrived. They occasionally looked and smelled up at the people on the observation decks, but didn't seem too concerned.
I think the bears right now are actually looking fairly calm. They don't seem agitated. They seem to be, actually this is where they're laying right now, is where they slept over the night, so they're pretty comfortable, and they've been here several nights, so I think they've kind of walked around before trying to see a way out, and they haven't found one yet. So I think right now they're just kind of making time and being comfortable until they can get out.
Collaring and tagging these bears is not an easy process. They'll be shot with tranquilizers, and then in the few hours they're unconscious, blood samples, hair samples, and even a tooth will be taken for study. Now to the enclosure. The bears might have been comfortable before, but as soon as the sow sees the gun over the enclosure wall, she gets very agitated. She stands up on her hind legs, she chuffs, and then she charges, allowing for a clear shot, which hits her in the hip. She runs and stumbles and runs and stumbles for over 5 minutes. Suddenly, we hear a growling, whining noise coming from the enclosure.
It's surgical quality tranquilization, anesthesia, so she'll be down. And she's just, it's just catching up with her now, and so she's groggy on her feet, but in just a minute or two, she'll be completely immobilized and unconscious.
Now, they'll try to tranquilize the cubs. I follow Les Kinnear down and into the enclosure. Biologist Phil Mooney is right behind. Les Kinnear and I head over to the sow while Mooney approaches the cubs. He shoots them with a tranquilizer gun. One of them runs over to see what we're doing before the drugs take full effect. And this is where we come to the snoring. The sow is laying on her stomach with all four legs out to her sides, and she's snoring up a storm. While she's peacefully out of it, the biologist will take samples and put the radio collar on before the drugs wear off. And that's how bears are collared and tagged in the not-so-wild. The bears will recuperate at the fortress and be allowed and encouraged to leave back into the real wild. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ben Matheson in Nome, Ed Schoenfeld and Matt Miller in Juneau, and Ed Ronco and Shady Grove Oliver in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.